guardian.co.uk.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Book Club. This month's club is devoted to The Reluctant Fundamentalist, the Booker shortlisted novel by Mohsin Hamid, which was picked by The Guardian as one of the novels that defined the decade. It's the story of a Pakistani man who decides to leave his high-flying life in America after the terrorist attacks of 9/11 and the failure of a love affair. That's where it begins. But as John Mullen pointed out to Mohsin, it's never explained to us what actually happens at the end. So his first question was, could he please enlighten us?
I can't help you out in the sense of telling you what happens at the end. But I can help you out in the sense of telling you how I built the book. So I try to build a room, or rooms, a building, inside which things can happen. You can dance, you can fall in love, you can cry, you can, you know, barge out very quickly. And so for me, the ending of the book is hopefully the point at which you become aware of that. But it's not that I have in mind, you know, Chinggis shoots the guy shoots Chinggis, or it's revealed that there is no guy and Chinggis has had some mental breakdown and he's just sort of speaking to himself. It's not that. For me, the ending is hopefully the point at which the reader becomes more aware of the fact that they have been creating the novel as they read. It also comes to sort of the idea of what a political novel is. I don't think the novel is a very good form to write an op-ed piece. The job of a political novel, or the form and function of a political novel, is to engage the reader's politics and to reflect the reader's politics. The difference between a book and a film and TV is in film and television, the story is more fully imagined for you. If it were food, it's been chewed before Mother Bird bends down and puts it in your mouth. You know, the novel is an independent wriggling worm. It's not pre-chewed. Books are the way in which people get to create. It's one of the ways in which people are still able to create throughout their lives. When they read a book, they create. Because the book is just text. I try to make my books, or I've tried to make my first two books, Mott's Book and Reluctant Fundamentalist, books in which actually it's not up to me. It's up to both of us.
But you have chosen a kind of, I think, terrifically ambiguous way of turning into fiction a subject which filmmakers, TV makers, TV filmmakers, but also other novelists sort of tackled over the last decade, and which is, you know, fundamentalism and jihadism and things. And there have been quite a few attempts.
The power of fundamentalism, or you know, this idea, which is done so much in terms of action and reaction in our world, we look outside to find it. Who are these fundamentalists? What are they doing? How are they trying to kill us, etc.? But for me, what's much more interesting is the internal question of within us, what does fundamentalism do? When Osama bin Laden attacked America, of course, there are 3,000 people who are massacred on that day, but the reaction also comes from within. It's not that Osama bin Laden chose the invasion of Afghanistan or the invasion of Iraq. That came from somewhere else. It came from inside the decision makers in America who decided to do those things. What's much more interesting is how it works inside us. What does the idea of fundamentalism do to us? You know, what does it evoke? The other thing was to say, you know, fundamentalism is powerful, not just because of what it is, because who knows what it is. It's powerful because of what it does to us. Everybody all around the world, the way that we react to it, how do we as human beings react to the fear that is so easy to stoke once the notion of fundamentalism gets injected into our world? There's a concept that exists in I think, most religions around the world. And in Sufism, which is sort of the mystical offshoot of Islam, this concept is expressed in this way, that it is possible to gaze at the universe. You know, you look at the clouds, the stars, the sea, whatever, and to see yourself reflected in the universe, and to, you know, to look at the world around you and come to recognize yourself. The flip side of this is that you can look inside yourself and see reflected the universe. And you know, if you think about it in visual terms, it's as though you can look out through a to a telescope and you see these galaxies and constellations, and you look through an electron microscope or something even more sophisticated than that, and you see equivalent galaxies that make up the atoms that are us, and there's a kind of unity in that act. My project was a bit like that. Is it possible to find in the reader some of these notions that are fundamentalism and its reaction that isn't necessarily in the world outside, but can just be brought into being? Mm,
mm. There's a kind of almost a pun, isn't there, about fundamentalism in the novel, which connects the two parts of the narrator's life, I suppose, his life as a kind of whiz kid, the New York valuation company, and then his life when he's gone back to Lahore, back to Pakistan. What is the relationship between those two kinds of fundamentalism?
I think fundamentalist ideologies, if we want to describe what they are ideologies that have a starting point, which says, here is something that is intrinsically right.
Yeah.
So this is intrinsically right because the prophet or God or whatever said so. Or it's intrinsically right because my particular belief system says so. So for example, when people talk about the valuation of BP, BP is worth some very large number of pounds. And so Chinguez works at this corporate firm and he's valuing companies. And what it comes down to is you look at the profits of a company in the future, you figure out how much it will, what the cost of capital is, which is some notion of here's the risk implicit in buying this company. You bring that back down through a mathematical formula to a valuation today. So it'll make this much profit. We just take this interest rate. Here's what it's worth today. That is the company. But of course, if you view the world that way, you wind up with, I think, a world that is very strange for most of us to live in. And so the book, Chinguez is doing this stuff, valuing these companies, and he begins to empathize with the people he's, in the companies that he values with, and finds it difficult to just keep valuing them in this way. And so he's a reluctant employee whose job is to value companies on the basis of their fundamentals. And I'm not trying to sort of say that there's some, banal equivalence between Osama bin Laden and the CEO of Barclays Bank, but I'm saying that the belief systems are parallel in the way that they work. And that's why, in a sense, that both of them are so nihilistic, that you can have this, let's just slaughter all these people to make this change happen viewpoint on one side, and let's erect this completely preposterous, debt-ridden society that's going to crash on all of our heads on the other side. And I think that's where this idea of the Russian fundamentalist comes, which is that we are all born with a sense of empathy, and empathy rebels against fundamentalism.
The tricky and rewarding thing for the reader of the novel is valuation. Actually, the narrator, Chinguez, uses the word valuation of what his mentor at the company, Underwood Sampson, does. In some ways, I thought it was a clever and a satisfying thing. That process of valuation as a kind of psychological, okay, perhaps manipulative, but still real insight there. You remember that when you notice what Chinguez is doing with his supposed listener, his American companion.
Chinguez is not trying to put himself in the shoes of the American. It's not empathy he's engaged in.
No.
He is trying to put the American's feet into a pair of shoes that he has already set out.
Yeah.
And that, of course, is what valuation and,
speaking as, I'm head of department in my department, one of my students the other day referred to me, to my face, unironically, as management. That's it. It's over.
Wow.
But I thought we were taught to recognize another person's style of thought, harness their agenda, redirect it to achieve our desired outcome. Indeed, one might describe it as a form of mental judo for business.
It exists.
Must have learned.
Yeah, when I was working as a management consultant, it was interesting. I went to this training, number of training programs, and at one of them, we were taught, that there are different modes of influencing people.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, you can, if somebody is prone to appeals to authority, you say, the CEO sent me. You know, if somebody instead is, you know, somebody else, you know, likes to be sort of passionately engaged, you craft that sort of a thing. You know, we can make this company, you know, win. If it is, you know, more of a sort of team building thing, you know, you and I, we're going to do this.
There are some hints with Ching as a narrator that if we're tackling the question of do we trust him, there are one or two places where quite explicitly he says something that is not true or that he doesn't mean. Now, it may be that you could say that, because you've also very cleverly made him as a very polite person. So there's the thing with the beggar, which kind of sort of pushed me a bit sideways, because the beggar comes and the American doesn't give him any money. And he says to him something like, oh, you're quite right, of course, much better to give to charity, deal with the problem systematically. You'll see that I am giving some money, but that's because, you know, I'm just in the habit, it's a thoughtless habit of ours. And at that moment, you think, well, this is a narrator who says one thing, but clearly thinks something completely different.
That's right. And later in the novel, there's a moment or two where you know, he says, you know, I'm not sure it actually happened that way, but, you know, it's moving swiftly on.
Yes.
And I think that's right. I mean, he does encourage you. In fiction, there's this idea of the unreliable narrator, and it's existed, you know, from the beginning of time, I suppose. So, you know, one of the books that I read early on as a writer, in fact, I wrote the first draft of my first novel, Mothsmoke, for a creative writing workshop taught by Toni Morrison at Princeton. And I was writing this novel, and she said to me, have you read this book? And it was Ishiguro's Remains of the Day.
Yeah.
And I hadn't read it. And she said, you know, read this. I think you know, you're writing these unreliable narratives. I think you'll learn from it. And I did, and I think it's brilliant. Ishiguro's one of my favorite writers, British writers in particular, but writers in the world. And what I was trying to do in The Latin Fundamentalist was the unreliable narrator, where we know he's unreliable, but we also don't know what is he. So I think that happens less often because the unreliable narrator can be a very poignant way of delivering the truth, but the unreliable narrator is just baffling. In the traditional dramatic irony, it is clear that there's an audience and there are characters. And in our actual lives, that is not clear. You know, we are both audience and character in real life. And so, you know, in The Latin Fundamentalist, what I'm trying to do is to approximate that more, that have the reader be both character and actor and have the same kind of befuddlement that dramatic irony doesn't give us.
We've got a travelling mic. Anybody? Oh, we've got two travelling mics. Anybody here would like to ask or say something, please?
I've read before that you take a long time to write books. I think 7 years is the number that was referenced in a Guardian article about you. I think it also said that you did the first draft of this book in July 2001. Could you talk about what the first draft was like versus where you ended up at the end of the process, and specifically how September 11th impacted that journey?
When I wrote the first draft of the book, and I finished it in July 2001, about a month and a half before September 11th. At the time, it was a story of a Pakistani man working in corporate New York, America, who decides he can't stay, and after a sort of failed love affair, moves back, grows a beard, and goes back to Pakistan. And central to it was this idea of being a Janissary, being a modern-day equivalent of these young boys who are kidnapped from the Balkans, in the most part, Christian boys, taken to the Ottoman Empire, brought up as soldiers, and then sent back as administrators in the very places that they had come from, but with total allegiance to the Ottoman Empire, not to their heritage. That was what the book was about. And I wrote it as a quiet fable, you know, just a sort of gentle little delicate thing, which my agent didn't particularly like and said to me at the time, you know, this Muslim man is in America, he feels a sort of tension. You know, I don't buy it. And, you know, 2 months later, he said, you know, that book you're working on. And at the end of the day, it was a story of a man who must decide between embracing his hybridity or trying to repurify himself, which is obviously impossible, but trying to repurify himself. What complicates the choice is that his new hybridity, this Pakistani-American identity, he's no longer just Pakistani, he's sort of Pakistani plus American, mixed up, is coming about in a world, in a corporate world, that tries to deny empathy, that tries to say, you know, here's the objective, let's not care about who gets fired. And that's what the book is still about. What changed, of course, was September 11th happened and this whole connotation of violence. Although even when I wrote the first draft, the idea that he grew a beard would, I thought, would be off-putting to people around him and it would connote this stuff. And for many years afterwards, I tried to keep September 11th out of the book. As I rewrote the novel, first person, third person, American accent, you know, I tried so many different things. I tried resolutely to keep it set before September 11th, because I didn't want the politics of September 11th to swamp these characters in the story. And eventually I thought it was impossible because, you know, you write a novel that ends with the Pakistani man leaving New York the months before September 11th, the reader will then say, ah, and then September 11th happens. So eventually it came in and the book had to change. But that's how it all began.
I'm interested in your writing process. There doesn't seem to be a spare word at all yet to put it down. I've not had a book which has resonated for so long. I read it a couple of years ago and still think about it regularly. So my question is, how do you self-edit yet have such an impact?
The two things guided me, you know, and in my first novel, Malt Smoke, the same thing applied. Most people I grew up with didn't read literary fiction in Pakistan. Even now in Pakistan, where Malt Smoke actually is a much more widely read book than Rotten Fundamentalist, people come up and say, you know, it's the only novel I've ever read. That's the praise. And actually, for me, that's high praise, because that was my intention, was to write a book somebody who doesn't like to read literary fiction might read. And among the ways that I tried to do that, you know, in addition to the High Noon style tension, you know, which is that you feel like something has just grabbed you by the throat and pulling you through. Tick, tick, tick. But also was to make it small. It's less scary if it's small. The discipline that I used was I wrote 12 chapters of precisely 12 manuscript pages each. There's no reason to do that. I mean, it was a totally arbitrary choice on my part. If music is sort of mathematics made into emotion, I wanted to take something of that idea into how I built this book. And so that then gave me the discipline to just cut out whatever I didn't need. And so I wrote over 1,000 pages of manuscript for this tiny little 180-page book.
You pretty carefully imply that the fundamentalist in the title is not, in fact, a religious fundamentalist, but somebody who works in fundamentals in the city. Yet, by giving it a title like that, you pretty much are making something of a political snipe, aren't you? Can you explain what is the political point you're trying to make?
I'm not trying to really make a political point so much. what I'm trying to do with the book is more than making a political point, or at least a political lens that you are aware of looking through, a colored lens. But the title, on the one hand, you're right. You know, it is a play on the idea that he's the fundamentalism he does is focus on the fundamentalism, focus on the fundamentals, the Underwood Sampson sort of mantra. But also, the idea is that, you know, he comes to be perceived as a religious fundamentalist, even though there's nothing about him which we can tell is particularly religious. The only religious moment in the novel is when he gets his job and he says, "Thank you, God." Other than that, you know, there's no religion in this man. He's a secular humanist as far as we can tell. But, I mean, he may be religious, but the novel doesn't tell us that he is. So he's a reluctant fundamentalist in that he's like so many people of Muslim heritage or apparently Muslim appearance suddenly found themselves being queried as potential fundamentalists. You know, he's among that group where reluctantly he comes to be seen as a fundamentalist. But also, reluctantly, he comes to behave in some ways that plausibly could be parallel to what a religious fundamentalist, how a religious fundamentalist might behave. So it's not that the novel entirely rejects that kind of stereotypical idea. But the title I thought was important because, you know, the title suggests a certain meaning. It's a red cape and it invites a charge. The cape does get lifted and the charge continues on its own.
I mean, even the cover actually is quite a sort of teases the reader into some sort of guesses about where we're heading.
Absolutely. And I was involved in this cover design. It was very funny because, you know, I've never really been involved in cover design before. And we, my editor, Simon Prosser, and I, and the art department at you know, Hamish Hamilton and Penguin, were talking about, you know, what should this thing look like, et cetera. And we're thinking. Different options popped up, et cetera. And then, you know, eventually it was, well, you know, maybe he's looking at this thing and whatever. And I said, you know, I think it's important that he maybe be holding a flower. And, you know, we have this New York skyline, we have this thing of him looking at, you know, from potentially a Pakistani setting at New York, which is, of course, what the novel sort of does. And there's a the cover has a frame. The novel, of course, is a framed narrative. But I thought, you know, this flower is really important. You can barely see. You might even think it's just like a rag or a blotch in your copy. But
I don't think I'd suss the flower.
Yes, but that was my
typical.
Artistic.
I've got no visual.
That was my core artistic contribution to this thing, and I think it's made all the difference, actually.
And I was wondering at what stage you thought of the title. Was it before you wrote the book, or was it... Obviously, it was early on, you said that already, but yeah. How early on in the process did you think of the title?
Well, you know, I was working as a management consultant in New York after law school. I had $100,000 of debt after law school, which is something people in the UK will soon be used to. So I thought, I'm going to get myself a job where I can pay this back quickly so I can write my books. And I got a job as a management consultant in New York. And when I was doing my training... We learned about this thing of, you know, valuing companies on their fundamentals. And I remember one drunken evening sitting and writing this, you know, crazed email about, you know, values and whatever that I was going to send to the head of our firm. Luckily, I never sent it. But it did have an impact on me that, you know, that this idea of the fundamentals and, you know, what we were all about. And because there is something quasi-spiritual about it, this... look at the world through these eyes. In so doing is wisdom, enlightenment, wealth, whatever. And that really resonated with me because it was quite a shock coming from an American liberal arts education. You know, in the United States, when you go to college, when you do your BA, it was, at least back then, a wonderful experimentation. You know, I could take courses in everything. Here in the UK, for the most part, your university degree is focused on one area. But when I was in college in the States, I took religion, Japanese politics, you know, Persian, economics, mathematics, whatever. You know, it was like 4 more years of O-levels, really. It's a shock to go from, you know, professors, you know, telling you, you know, to read Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance to, you know, sitting in a seminar just a few years later where it's, you know, here's how you value things on their fundamentals. And so that stuck with me. This insistence on fundamentals, and of course, being from Pakistan, immediately became apparent this, you know, the fundamentalism, etc. Not everybody liked this title, I have to say. I mean, there was a big bookstore chain that wasn't too keen on it. But
presumably, you're working on the next novel. Is that also taking you 7 years?
I hope not. It's been 4.
Wow.
And
we're heading 7wards, aren't we?
Yeah, but I've using a much more efficient process and best practices from other writers and I hope to shave it down to 6. Seriously, I hope to shave it down to 6. It could be 7. I'll know by the end of this year if the draft I'm writing now works. It'll be hopefully published year after next, which will make it 6. If it doesn't work, it'll be at least 7, if not longer. I don't know how to write my novels, and it takes me a long time to figure them out. Like, I'm still learning, really, how to write a book. But that's also partly because I don't want my next book to be, you know, formally or any other way my previous book. And so I'm always trying to figure out, okay, I know basically what story I want to tell, but what is the right form, voice? How can it work? And so each novel for me has been a self-education, you know, just sort of trying to figure it out. And the one thing which I like about that is sometimes I learn the most about how to write a book when I'm not writing it. So, for example, I'm in the UK for, you know, a few weeks and I've set the novel down before I came. But I have, you know, my notebook and very often things are coming to me and I'm solving things, you know, by not being with the novel every day. It's sitting, I mean, obviously it's on my computer, I could write it here, but somehow it's sitting at my desk in Pakistan, and I'm not going to work on it while I'm here. And being away from it, but it's still just percolating, it's funny how that happens. And so that's my particular approach to it, and it's a highly inefficient approach, which I hope to you know, for financial reasons, if nothing else, to speed up. But it's a mystery, and very often it's a sort of terrifying mystery, because for most of the lives of the writing of my books, they don't work at all. And I mean, for those of you who write yourselves, I'm sure you felt this, but there's a huge pleasure in being completely lost, and eventually finding your way, and that's what writing is like for me, and that's what I love about it.
It strikes me that there's a lot of prescience in this book. So you wrote it before September 11 actually happened, and furthermore, quite recently there was an incident in Lahore which could have almost been the sequel, you know, the unimagined, the unstated sequel to that scene, right? So where the CIA operative encountered these two chaps, and it could have come straight out of the pages of the novel. Mm. So I thought, you know, given that you're so prophetic, and given that there's been so many changes in Pakistan itself since then, what's your prognosis for, you know?
Oh, you're Nostradamus now.
Oh no! Oh no! I don't know, is the honest. I mean, I try to be a realist. I hope to be a realist, but actually I try more to be an optimist. But I don't know is the short answer for what's going to happen in Pakistan. Nobody obviously knows, but, you know, the war in Afghanistan and also Iraq, but mainly Afghanistan was only partly about, I think, about protecting against future terrorist attacks. It also was, understandably so, born out of a desire for, I think, revenge, justice, wounded pride. All of these things were caught up in it as well. And with Osama bin Laden's death, some of those other things maybe can now be set aside. And people can look at this thing and say, you know, if the goal now is, you know, the perpetrator is gone, justice has been done, it is what we are doing in Afghanistan, Pakistan, whatever, actually making the world safer for terrorism? Maybe that question can once again become the primary question. And I think if it does, what's likely to happen is that the militarization of this whole place could go down. And if it goes down, Pakistan effectively is in a civil war, because the Pashtuns in Pakistan spill over to the Pashtuns in Afghanistan. They are caught up in a struggle, in a war in Afghanistan, so Pakistan is, you know, on two sides, etc. I think if that war can be brought to an end, then things will be very good for Pakistan. So I guess what I'm saying is, you know, I don't know what the future holds, but I think the place is resilient, and there are reasons to think that the future might have some improvements in it, but it's a scary time. I mean, there's no doubt about it when friends of mine take their kids out of school for a couple of weeks at a time because there's a rumor going around that some suicide bomber is going to attack a children's school, you know you're not in good times. But you know, hopefully it'll get better.
Changes, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's French for a change, in imperative. So just wondering.
It's interesting. My French translator, my French publisher told me that. Okay. I didn't know. and they said, you know, this name, changer. And I said, well, it's chingez, but they said, you know, but it's we can't have it in French. Yeah. And I said, you know, why not? And they said, well, it's a bit banal. So in French, they went with T-C-H-E-N-G-U-I-Z. To Changuiz, you know, Changuiz, which I think is the French spelling for Genghis, which of course is what the name comes from. The name Changuiz is the Urdu version of Genghis. Okay. And only later did somebody tell me, oh, his name is changes and he changes. And I thought, I guess so. And Genghis was interesting in two different directions. One is because, of course, Genghis is a warrior. And the novel plays with this idea of Chinggis as a warrior, a kind of corporate warrior. Yeah. You know, the sort of the merciless meritocracy of the Mongols, you know, where the sons of the Mongol king had to kill each other to pick who was the best warrior to become the next king. You know, that's serious meritocracy. And it'd be interesting if we tried that out here in the UK, actually. So this is going on, this warrior metaphor. But also because the historical Genghis you know, Genghis, invades the Eastern Muslim Empire, you could call it, majority Muslim civilization, which at the time is the most advanced in the world. So, you know, he's sweeping down into a place where in Baghdad, for example, you've got a city of 1 million people with tenured professors, peer-reviewed medical journals, crop rotation, you know, mathematical astronomy, the works. It's a very sophisticated society. It's probably more sophisticated in many ways, you know, than academia in much of Iraq probably is now, because they had the idea of tenured chairs funded by rich merchants that gave professors independent. I mean, you know, it was seriously advanced 800 years ago. It was the Renaissance before the Renaissance, really. Genghis obliterates this. You know, they slaughter hundreds of thousands of people in Baghdad alone, the biggest city in the world. And it takes them a week because it just that's how long it takes for a bunch of guys with swords to chop that many heads off. The name Genghis is a violent name, but deeper within it is it's a very strange name for a Muslim fundamentalist to bear. You know, it runs against the grain because he's reviled by you know, Muslim nationalists.
I'm sure we could go on, but we must release Mohsin. We've signed books if you
sure happily yeah. happily.
And if you'd like to have your book signed, please do queue up and he'll do it. And just for me to say thanks so much.
Thank
for
you.
Giving us so much and for talking to us so interestingly.
Thank you very much.
You don't clap.
The first. All right, no. All of them and you.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.